All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and CW2 type helicopter pilot, Vietnam, 1969. We want to welcome everybody to Veterans Radio today. We're so proud to have you listening to us and so honored to be on the air and be able to tell you these amazing stories of these men and women that we do every week here on Veterans Radio. To get it started, we're going to be talking about an event that's coming up here in the local Ypsilanti area. We are, for those of you that are not aware, we broadcast from the studios of WAAM Ann Arbor, 1600 AM, Talk Radio 1600. If you'd like to get in on the conversation here with us, you can give us a call at 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. If you want to call long distance, as in free, you can get us at 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can send me an email during the program at dale@veteransradio.com, and we'll get that information. We want you to really participate. As I mentioned, we have an event coming up here locally. And after we talk about that, we're going to have our main guest on the program. And this is Medal of Honor recipient Sammy Davis. And Sammy received his Medal of Honor in 1968 for actions in 1967. It's very exciting to have Sammy on our program. He just come out with a new book called You Don't Lose Till You Quit Trying. And I think that that's very appropriate. And we're going to be talking about what he did to receive the Medal of Honor and what the Medal of Honor has done to his life over the last 45, 50 years. So you better stick around for that. We also have some Michael J. Martin music that we're going to be playing for all of you Vietnam veterans who know Michael J. Martin and Doc Holliday. And it's going to be cool. It's going to be very exciting. So stick around all hour. You don't want to miss any of this today. Right now, joining me on the line is a personal friend and spokesman for the upcoming events on the 4th of July, John Luker. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
It is my pleasure. So, what's happening, John?
The Vietnam Veterans of America is teaming up with Team Red, White, and Blue and several other community organizations across a six-county area to put on a picnic family event on the 4th of July.
Okay, and what time is this going to be?
We're going to kick the picnic off around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That should give everybody a chance to go to the different parades that are happening, like the one in Ypsilanti should be getting over around 12:31. That'll give them a little bit of a chance to regroup and come on out to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial at around 2 o'clock.
And for those people within the 25, 50-mile radius of our voice right now, where is the Washtenaw County Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
It is on East Huron River Drive. If you get off the I-94 Expressway and head south on Huron Street, Huron River Drive will be right near a church-type intersection. It'll be before you get to Kroger's and all of those other the strip mall. Mm-hmm. Turn left on here on River Drive, and you'll see it on your right side after a quarter of a mile.
It's a very, very neat beautiful monument that I know that you were probably involved in that as well, John, along with all the other different veterans groups in Washtenaw County, especially Mr. Kinzinger and the VVA 310, right?
Yes, especially the VVA 310.
I realize that. So, again, this is on the 4th of July. And
yes.
What are we going to be able to do if we come out there on that 4th of July?
Well, we've got it set up. So what we're trying to do is provide an opportunity for the older vets and the younger vets to have an opportunity to just sit down and talk with each other. And we want the families to have that very same opportunity. So we're trying to recreate the old-fashioned community picnic feel. And so we're going to provide hot dogs, hamburgers, beans, potato salad, potato chips, water, beer, for the food. We are going to have all kinds of games, yard games like croquet, mm-hmm. bocce ball, badminton, that kind of thing. We're going to have quite a few of them that are designed so that the whole family can participate, like the three-legged sack races and all that kind of thing. We're going to have music streaming in the background, and the music will be targeted to reach all of the different age groups. So,
well, that'll be fun. Are you going to have any? Are there any live performers going to be there this time?
We are asking for a few live performers, but we have not confirmed any yet.
All right. So, any of you men and women out there who are talented with guitars or harmonicas and like to sing patriotic or rock and roll songs, get in touch with John, right?
Exactly. And along that line, my telephone number is 734-260-2211.
2211?
Yes.
734-260-2211. I understand, I was talking to Mark Lindke, that you're hoping to have some displays and maybe some organizations that are out there trying to help veterans?
Yes, only instead of setting it up like we do at the regular kind of fairs, like the Yellow Ribbon events that are thrown for the National Guard units when they return home, and having, you know, like booths and everybody stuck at their booth and having to wait for people to stop by, what we're going to do at this event is to ask the resource people to just become part of the crowd and mingle with all of the rest of the vets and the families so that they can have the genuine conversation.
Right.
But they are also going to bring the same kinds of stuff that they would bring to those seminars. We'll have tables set up so that they'll have their flyers and the giveaways displayed as well.
Okay. And this, again, is going to be on Monday, the 4th of July. What time?
At 2 o'clock. It will go essentially until dark. So if you have things that you have to do and you're going to eat with your family or something somewhere else, and you can't get there till 5 o'clock in the afternoon, feel free to come on out. We'll still have some refreshments. We'll still have the games. We'll still have the music. And we'll have starting around dusk, we'll have a campfire that will go until everybody goes home.
Until everybody goes home. Sounds like a great idea, John. Thanks for helping to put this whole thing together. I hope I can get out there and see you all. And again, this is on the 4th of July, starting at 2, going till whenever. And it's at the Washtenaw County Vietnam Veterans Memorial out on Huron River Drive off of, is that Whitaker Road? No.
Yeah, Whitaker or Huron.
Right. Okay.
Names at that intersection.
All right. Well, we'll bring it up again for the next couple of weeks. Make sure they get there.
All right. Thank you very much. I sure appreciate that.
All right, John. Thank you very much.
Take care.
All righty. We'll see you. All right, folks, so make sure, put this on your calendar. That's why Bob always says, make sure you have a pencil and something to write on. We've got a great picnic coming up on the 4th of July here in Washtenaw County. You don't have to live in Washtenaw County. Come on down. Everybody's welcome. We want you all to show up there. Meet all these veterans that are living in the area. I think you'll find it very interesting and a good opportunity for everybody to meet the veterans and their families, and this is a way for helping our families and our kids to let them know that the 4th of July is a very important day in America, and we want to make sure people celebrate. That's another day. Oh, it reminds me. Fly your flag, folks. Put the flag out there on your house, on a tree. I don't care where you put it, but put it out there so people can see that you've got your flag out. All right? Okay, we're going to take a real fast break, and then we're going to pay a couple of bills, and then when we come back, our guest of the program, Sammy Davis, Medal of Honor recipient. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. PFC Sammy Davis is often called the real Forrest Gump. Details after this. Davis enlisted in the Army. He volunteered for the artillery because his father had been an artilleryman in World War II, and then asked to be sent to Vietnam. In November 1967, his unit was helicoptered into Fire Base Cudgel. Shortly after midnight, Battery C came under heavy mortar attack. At the same time, 1,500 Viet Cong launched an intensive ground assault.
Davis's squad was operating a 105-millimeter howitzer that fired 18,000 beehive darts in each shell. When he saw how close the VC were, he took over a machine gun and provided cover for his crew. Convinced they couldn't survive the attack, he rammed a shell into the gun and fired point blank into the enemy. A mortar round exploded nearby, knocking Davis to the ground, but he got up and kept firing the howitzer. When he ran out of beehives, he fired a white phosphorus shell, and then the last round he had, a propaganda shell filled with leaflets. He heard yelling from the other side of the river, and despite the fact that he couldn't swim, paddled across on an air mattress. Other GIs followed him. He found three wounded soldiers, gave them morphine, and provided covering fire as another GI helped one of the wounded across the river. Davis pulled the other two through the water on the air mattress and resumed the fight. Just before dawn, Davis was wounded in the back and buttocks by friendly fire. President Johnson presented him the Medal of Honor on November 19, 1968. Footage of LBJ putting the medal around Davis' neck appeared in the movie Forrest Gump, with Tom Hanks' head substituted for Davis's. Gump's fictional citation was loosely based on Davis' real one.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And now joining me on Veterans Radio is Medal of Honor recipient Sammy Davis. Sammy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. It's good to talk with everybody.
It's good to hear from you. He mentioned that was our partner Ken Rogge that put together that little Medal of Honor thing. Were you drafted or were you enlisted?
Oh no, sir, I enlisted.
You enlisted. All right, and as he put in there that you were you decided to join the artillery, correct?
Yes, sir, because my dad had been in the artillery before me.
And where did you end up doing basic training?
Fort Jackson, South Carolina, B-62, best on the hill, sir.
We all remember. B-52, yes, sir. it's amazing what we remember, right?
Sure, it's still there.
I'm sure that it, I don't think mine is. I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana, so.
Where the skeeters as big as eagles.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, there were. All right. I want to get into your story. I don't want to get into Vietnam yet because you had interesting experiences just getting there, it seems like, when you went into artillery and so forth. And when did you enlist? What year was that?
I enlisted September the 28th, 1966.
1966. And you were in Vietnam by when?
I got there March the 7th, 1967.
They don't waste time, do they?
No, sir. Basic training, AIT, and I got to come home for 30 days and then went to Vietnam.
And where did you grow up, Sammy?
Well, I graduated from high school in Mooresville, Indiana.
I know you moved around quite a bit, though.
Your dad was in construction, and we moved all over.
That is true. All right, so you arrive in Vietnam, and where did you start off there?
I started the night that we landed at Tan Snoot Air Base in Vietnam. They blew up the Long Bin ammunition dump, which was the largest ammunition storage facility in the world at that time. And they blew it up. So they pulled 100 of us, struck our original orders, and made us pad guards on the Long Bin ammunition dump. And I was guard there at the ammunition dump from March till the end of May.
Okay, that was I was stationed at Long Bin myself.
I was just at Long Bin last week.
I know. I want to talk about that a little bit later on. I'm sure it doesn't look quite the same.
No, sir, it doesn't look anything the same.
But we flew out of a airfield there called Plantation, which one of the Axis flew directly over the 90th Replacement Company.
Oh, yes, sir.
And our gunship maintenance area was, you could look out and see the ammo dump for Long Bin. In fact, one of our gunship guys was hooking up a rocket system, and we had built up some static electricity and sent a rocket out into the dump and blew it up again in 1969. So you're out there guarding the ammunition dump. You ran into some interesting experiences out there, too, didn't you?
Well, yes, sir. We had a Black Panther that would tracked us around. He never created any real problems, but just seeing a panther from a country boy from southern Indiana, that's very frightening. And we had wild pigs that would come in, and we had tin cans with rocks in them tied to the concertina wire that surrounded it, the pads, and they'd come right through, and you could hear the rocks jingling in the cans, and that meant somebody was coming through, so that would always get us all riled up and scared, and then come to find out it would just be one of the wild pigs, the warthogs. So.
Well, Sammy, how old were you when you arrived in country?
I was 20 years old.
Okay. I'm asking this for our audience's sake to realize how young that soldiers are when they go to war.
Yes, sir.
And I was talking to somebody earlier this evening and saying, you know, American foreign policy is at the end of a gun held by a 20-year-old, which is kind of be a little bit frightening to not to everybody, most of all to the 20-year-old, I think.
It certainly was, yes, sir.
So, and as you mentioned, you were guarding the ammo dump for 3 or 4 months, and then where'd you go?
Well, then we got orders cut, and I went to 9th Infantry Division, C Battery, 2nd of the 4th Artillery at Tan Tru, Vietnam.
And where in the world is that?
Tan Tru is about, Tan An. Do you know where Tan An is?
The name sounds familiar.
Not Tan An, but Tan An.
Right.
We were 12 miles south of Tan An, right on the river.
All right, and this is down in Four Corps.
Yes, sir.
All right,
yes,
so you're down in the Delta, and we've got some veterans that live in the local area that were down in the Delta, and I was just talking to one the other day, and he was saying,
outstanding.
Oh, you know, it's pretty flat and just water.
Indeed, it is.
And the water would creep up every once in a while, and you described this in your story. We're talking to Sammy Davis, a Medal of Honor recipient, and he's just recently written a book entitled You Don't Lose Till You Quit Trying, and we'll find out the importance of that phrase in just a little bit. If you want to get in on a conversation, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. So now you're down in the Delta. Can you tell our audience what it is? What was your job down there?
I was an artilleryman. I started off just being the ammo handler and then worked my way up and finally got to be number two guy, which...
What does that mean for a civilian? What does or a Navy guy? We have a Navy guest in our control room tonight. He goes, what the heck does that mean?
Number two, I've controlled the elevation of the tube.
Okay.
So when our fire direction control would say give us the numbers that would determine the direction in which we fired, and then the elevation that the tube had to be, and then the charge to put in the howitzer. Well, I was the guy that controlled the elevation of the tube.
Okay. And how big was this howitzer?
It's a 105 millimeter, so it's a big, weighs 2.5 tons.
Okay. We're just enlightening our audience. Everybody thinks everybody's so light and little small things that you can move around easily.
Oh, no, they're big and heavy.
Big and heavy. All right. So this was your job down there. You did other things down in the Delta, too, didn't you?
Well, yes, sir. I was able to, now that while I was still at the ammunition dump, I got to be door gunner. I would, because we worked all night, and because it was 100 degrees during the day, it was hard to sleep, so I didn't sleep a whole lot. And a friend of mine was in a helicopter outfit, and he said, well, Sam, we sure do need some door gunners. And I said, well, you know, it's nice and cool up there, so I would go volunteer and be a door gunner for usually 2 to 4 hours during the day. I mean, sometimes it was longer, I loved it because it was nice and cool when you got up in the air.
Yeah, as long as you stayed up in the air, you know, it's getting down on the ground got a little exciting.
Yes, sir.
It did. What unit was that you flew with?
You remember? Oh, my goodness. It was right there at Long Bend, but at the moment I don't remember the unit designation numbers.
Okay. Well, right at Long Bend, there was a 195th and there was a 117th. We're right on the plantation right there by the ammo dump, and there were some other units spread around.
The 95th sounds right.
Well, that would be really weird because that was mine.
Really?
I'll have to go back and check. I'll have to go to our website and say, hey, guess who I had on my program today?
The pilot I usually flew with was Gary Ellis.
Boy, that sounds familiar. I'm going to have to look that one up, too. Wow. This is getting to be a smaller and smaller world, Mr. Davis.
Yes, there it is.
It certainly is. All right, so now you're down in the Delta, and to get our audience so they understand what's going on down there, is it a lot of water, a lot of heat, and a lot of humidity?
Yes, sir. Indeed it is.
And so...
pretty and green, though.
From the air, it was nice and green.
It was beautiful, yes, sir.
You don't have to call me sir. I'm just a warrant officer, in a former lifetime. So tell me what type of missions that you did with the artillery. Did you move around a lot, or were you...
We were very mobile. 105 Howitzer is the smallest of the artillery pieces that were being used at that time. The 155s were much bigger, and then the 175s were real, real big. So the 105s were air mobile, and they'd pick us up underneath a Chinook helicopter and take us out and set us down wherever we could best support the infantry. That was our job, was to provide fire support for the infantry. Sometimes we had to move two or maybe three times a day. I mean, that wasn't usual, but sometimes we did that. Usually if we was going out to help the infantry, we would be there for a day or two, and then they'd pick us back up and bring us back into Chantooch or base camp and be there a day or 2 days, whatever, and then they'd pick us up again and take us out to support. It all depended on what the infantry was doing.
Okay. And so they would just sling load your howitzer underneath a Chinook and drop you wherever they needed.
Ammunition.
That's always important. What were the conditions of setting up these howitzers? Because the ground was, in a lot of places in that area, was pretty soft.
Yes, sir. Well, they would always try to set us up in places that had a little bit of hard dirt with them, and they tried real hard. I mean, sometimes we were in knee-deep mud, but usually they could find a place that was decent. Not always, but usually.
Well, that's true.
Yes, sir. They tried very hard. They knew the difficulty of getting the gun set up. If it's hub-deep in mud and water, well, it's really hard to get set up and fire and to keep it stable so it'll hit where you're aiming at.
That was one of the questions I had, and we can get into that a little bit later on. But I did want to know about the recoil of these things. How much space did you need to set up the gun?
How much space did we need?
Yeah. So when you fired it, did you get any recoil off it, like it would back up?
Oh, usually it depended on how soft the dirt was. Mm-hmm. It had spades on the trails, big shovels on the back of the trails, okay. And so when you fired the gun, it would dig itself right in. Now, if it was good, solid dirt, well, then it would stay there. And if it wasn't, if it was in mud, we've had them slide back 6-8 feet before.
Okay. And this did occur on the night of in November of 67.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. We'll get started that. We have to take a break in about 4 minutes, 3 minutes. I've just been given a little high sign there. So what was going on there in 1967 on that fateful day?
November the 18th, 1967, we were airlifted out to support the infantry, 9th Infantry Division, and they were really getting hit with a lot of the enemy. And so we got a call. It was, well, we started firing almost as soon as they set us down, actually, and we fired really, really heavy all day until 5 o'clock in the evening, and then at 5 o'clock in the evening, the enemy finally backed away, and we were able to clean the gun up and get it squared away a little bit, and, you know, get it more stabilized, and it wasn't until 2 o'clock in the morning that they actually hit us. And they've tried their very best to overrun our artillery position, and we did our very best not to allow them to do that.
Well, that is understandable. What type of rounds did you carry with you?
Oh, we had the normal HE. We had white phosphorus, which is the marking round. That's how you fire the marking round first, and so the infantry knows that their grid coordinates are the same as ours, and that, you know, that's to let them know that we hit the target, and if the marking round hits where they want it to be, then it's followed by HE rounds immediately.
And HE is
explosive.
Heavy explosives?
High explosive, yes, sir.
High explosive. So that's the one that blows the big, 40-foot holes.
Well, the 105 don't blow quite that big a hole, but it blows a pretty good-sized hole.
Okay. And then what other types of rounds did you have with you?
Well, we had the white phosphorus marking rounds. We had, beehive round and the flechette rounds, which are same thing. And we had the propaganda rounds. And those were designed to be, I think it was like 1,500. You set the time fuse to burst at 1,500 foot up in the air, and then it would pop out all these leaflets.
Oh, okay. So you had the propaganda round with all the leaflets that would go out saying, get out of the way or don't come into this area because we're going to be firing, or, you could surrender now if you wanted to.
That's what we had, was the Chuhoy notes. Chuhoy basically means come home free.
Right.
Understand it.
Wow.
And we would fire that over known enemy locations so they would turn themselves in.
Okay. Well, we're going to be coming up on a break here, Sammy, so you can have a drink of water and so forth. I know you don't smoke anymore, which
no,
is
sir.
Good. And we'll come back and we're going to complete this mission. We are talking with Sammy Davis, who is a Medal of Honor recipient, and you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be back in probably a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
I took this ring off of Viet Cong in the springtime of my childhood. I saw his eyes when I shot him dead back then, it felt good. Now I'm putting the ring in the crack in the wall because I no longer need it. Hate's a monster that's always hungry and I ain't gonna feed it. I've been carrying this ring for 18 years and it's time to lay it down. Been a long time arriving, but I finally come around. Spent one long year in a field of stone and 18 more on the ground. Been carrying this ring for 18 years. It's time to lay it down.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. The music was provided by Doc Holliday and Michael J. Martin. And our guest today is Sammy Lee Davis, and Medal of Honor recipient for their actions in November 18th, 1967. He has recently written a book that I highly recommend it. You go out and get this. It's called You Don't Lose Till You Quit Trying. And boy, this guy certainly never gave up. It's an amazing story. And we're going to get back into it a little bit more. Sammy, I picked that music because I thought you would like it.
Well, yes, sir. Michael and Tim were my brothers. And in fact, my wife passed away and Tim Holliday passed away and I married his wife.
I know that. That's why I meant this whole world is getting so really weirdly smaller and smaller as we go
yes.
as we go along. And I always wanted to do this. Is a quick, real quick aside. Here at Veterans Radio, we've had the request from so many people to listen to Doc's and Michael J's music that I would love to put together just a program of just their music.
That'd be outstanding.
I think it would be too. And I have to get permission for the rights. I think I'll probably have to talk to your wife at least for one of those.
And then she can give you the permission. That's a fact.
We can do that. It's great, great stuff. We've got another song we're going to play toward the end of the program too for you.
Excellent.
All right. So let's. I know. I was looking at the book during the break real quick, and you. How did you get so friendly with General Westmoreland?
General Westmoreland.
I only met him once.
He was with the 9th Infantry Division in World War II. So he loved all the troops, but he shined particularly on the 9th Infantry Division troops, or that's the way he made us feel anyway. And he would be flying in his helicopter and would see us out sitting in the middle of the jungle on op, and he would land the helicopter and come over and talk to us. And on this day, we had three guns out on an operation, sitting in the middle of the jungle, and General Westmoreland's helicopter, I think there were three helicopters, came in and landed behind us, and General Westmoreland came walking up to us, and the captain come running by, and he said, we were doing a sustained fire, which means we weren't in really any actually combat situation at the moment. We were just doing sustained fire, trying to keep the enemy pushed back away from the infantry. And the captain said, when Westy comes to your gun, you quit firing. The other two guns will pick up the pace and just do whatever he wants. So, well, our gun was the last gun that he came to, and he walked up, and there were just three of us in the crew. We were shorthanded, so there were just three of us. And so I could hear the questions that he was asking the other two young men, and they were the questions that generals always ask. You know, you getting your one hot meal a day that you're supposed to get. You getting your letters from your home, from home, or you get to see, do you have services of a priest or rabbi or whatever you require? And of course, we knew that our job was to say, yes, sir, everything is wonderful. That was our job. And he stepped up to me and looked me right in the eye and looked down. Now, we were in the mud, so I was all muddy. And he looked down, and my boots had holes in the toes. I had three toes sticking out on each boot. And I could have turned them in and got new boots, but I didn't. My feet were doing better than some of the other kids. We called it trench foot, but it wasn't really trench foot. It was just, I don't know, from being wet all the time, I guess. But my feet were doing a little better than most of the other kids, and I'd related to the fact that the water actually drained out of my boots. When I got up out of the water, that water had actually drained out of them. So that's why I'd been wearing these boots with holes in them for several weeks. Well, when Westy looked down and seen my toes sticking out, well, I wiggled them at him, and his eyes got big, and he said, Private, is that the only pair of boots you had? And I told him the truth. Yes, sir, it was. Well, he turned to say something to my captain and noticed that my captain had brand-new boots on. And he turned back to me, and he said, Private, what size are those boots? And I said, 10W, sir. And he turned to my captain and said, what size are your boots, Captain? And my captain said, 10W, sir. He said, well, take them boots off and give them to that boy. So that's how I got to know General Westmoreland. This was just about my 21st birthday, which is November the 1st, because just a few weeks later was November the 18th, the night that I earned the medal. Well, then when I woke up in the hospital in Camp Zama, Japan, and they told me that they were going to send me home and retire me from the Army, and I said, well, you know, I don't want to go home. I don't want to retire from the Army. I want to go back to Vietnam and be with my brothers. What I didn't even know the word of it then was closure, because of the circumstances of we didn't have closure. We didn't have that opportunity to sit down after the battle and say, wow, you know, what just happened? Because I passed out. They put me on the helicopter and shipped me off. And I told them, I says, well, you know, I don't want to go home. I don't want to retire from the Army. General Westmoreland and I are good friends. We're just like this, you know, crossed my fingers. I said, he just gave me a new pair of boots a couple weeks ago. If you'll call General Westmoreland, he won't send me home. Well, in fact, the colonel in the hospital did get a hold of General Westmoreland's office, and so I got to go back to Vietnam. And that was how General Westmoreland and I started being really good friends. And he treated me like a son, and I loved him like a daddy.
That's a very cool story. I like that one a lot. Let's go back, unfortunately, to November 18th, 1967. You're down in the Delta. You've got a fire mission. And, in the book, you describe it as you're just looking up at the stars and all this, you know, watching the tracers go back and forth, kind of look like the 4th of July. And the next thing you know, the rounds are coming a lot closer.
A lot closer, yes, sir. It was, I had been, when we only fired one round as a crew that night, and it was direct fire right across the river, the canal that we were set up on, and when we fired, they fired the rocket at us, and as I was the number two guy, I was the guy that stood closest to the gun, and it hit the gun, it knocked everybody away from the gun, and blew me into my foxhole.
Wow.
And when the enemy came across the river and they were trying to pick my howitzer up, presumably to turn around to fire at my guys. Well, the gun crew behind me, seeing them doing this, and the standard rule is you don't never let the enemy take control of the weapon. So they fired the beehive. They thought we were all dead. And they fired the beehive over position, and that's how I got hit with beehive in my buttocks. From my mid-thigh up to and including my fourth lumbar vertebra, I had about 30 beehive holes in me. I had 7 beehives in me. Wow. With 30 holes where they just passed through me.
Right. For our audience, real quick, the Beehive are flechettes. These are little pieces of metal that
they look like an arrow, inch and an eighth to an inch and a quarter long.
Right. And they go flying out, and normally you fire these at the enemy as they're coming at you, kind of a last desperate thing.
Yes, sir. According to the Geneva Convention, you can only utilize the Beehive round unless you are in imminent danger of being overran. And we fell into that category, so we fired it.
All right. So now you got hit in the rear, so to speak.
And I was laying half in and half out of my foxhole up over the sandbags, the mud bags. Mm-hmm. But I did have my flak jacket on, thank goodness. And when the guys fired the Beehive, it hit me, and it woke me up. So that actually saved my life, because the enemy they were shooting all of us on. As they'd run past us, they'd shoot you again. So when they fired the Beehive round and hit me, it woke me up, and I rolled over into the bottom of my foxhole, and I'm laying there, my ears still ringing real big, and watching all those tracers. And I can remember thinking, wow, just like Christmas, because our tracers are red, and their tracers were white, blue, and green, depended on which communist nation was supporting it. And that night, evidently, they all were, because we had red, white, blue, and green tracers just flying everywhere.
Oh, man.
And
I've got goosebumps just listening to you.
As my head cleared, which I don't think took more than a few minutes, and I started hearing things again, and I thought, well, just seconds ago, to me it felt like seconds ago, I was standing at the gun, I remember the gun firing, and now here am I at. Well, where am I at? So I raised myself up. Well, my foxhole was right on the riverbank, and I could, when I raised up, there the enemy was coming across the river. The water was about waist deep on the most part, coming across when they were wading across.
Wow.
So I picked up my M16 and started doing my job as a soldier. And when I ran out of small arms ammunition, and here they still come, so I thought, well, maybe, now the gun's all blown up, but I thought, well, maybe I can get off one round. You don't lose till you quit trying, and I certainly wasn't going to quit trying that night. Mm-hmm. So I got the gun to fire, and it rolled over me because the recoil mechanism had been blown off of it. But it did its job, so I kept, as long as I could find a round, I would stick it in it and fire it and stick it in it and fire it. And the last round that I fired was the propaganda round with the Chuhoy notes in it, direct fire.
I'm sorry to be laughing. It's just, it's not something to really laugh about, but it is kind of appropriate that they get hit with this thing that says surrender, you know, go home.
Chuhoy
notes, thousands and thousands of them. But then you hear noises on the other side of the river.
Yes, sir. Well, after I had fired, by that point we had started getting illumination from another battery.
Okay.
So we could see more what was coming on, and I looked across the river when I heard somebody yelling, "Don't shoot, I'm a GI."
Mm-hmm.
And I looked, and sure enough, Gwendell Holloway, one of my brothers, was standing over there waving his beanie hat at me, and then he'd get back down in his foxhole. And I was just mortified that I'd been firing Beehive rounds, you know, at him for several hours. I'd been shooting across the river. So I said, well, I've got to go get him. Now, I knew how to swim, but because my body was in bad shape, I'd been hitting the right thigh with an AK-47. My back was broke. My ribs on the right side were crushed. I had 30 Beehive holes in me, and I was burnt because the gun was burning all the time that I was firing it.
So
it was because
you were sort of like a sponge.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It wasn't that I didn't know how to swim. I had a true inability. I believe I had a true inability to swim. So that's why I found the air mattress and blew it up and had to tie it off because there was big bullet holes in it. Finally, I got a spot that held enough air that I thought would hold me up, so I used that to get across the river. And when I got over there, there wasn't just one man, there were three men. And I brought all three of them back because I knew I didn't have the strength to make three trips. Mm-hmm. Because it took me half hour, 40 minutes just to get over there. And so I said, well, I prayed to the one above, and he gave me the strength to carry all three of my brothers at one time.
It's hard.
And one of the unique things is that last week I stood with one of those three men on the exact bank where I went across the river for him in Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And that was an awesome, awesome feeling.
I'll bet that it was. So, just for our audience, so obviously you survived this experience, which is just outrageous. Or I can't even think of a word that describes it for me. But so you were wounded so badly that you were eventually sent off to Japan, and then you used your connections.
Yeah, General Westmoreland stepped in. About 2 months after after I got back to my base, he let me go back to my base after I could walk, and he came and seen me when I was in the hospital there in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, son, what you probably don't know is that when that colonel called my office and then eventually talked to him, he said, what you probably don't know is that I had just laid down the last of the paperwork that would ultimately end up being your Medal of Honor citation. And he said, son, I would have given you the world, and the only thing you wanted was to go back and be with your brothers. And that's how I got to go back to Vietnam and be with my brothers."
And the whole time, much of the time that you were back there, you were going in and out of the hospital for treatment.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I still had, cotton in my wounds, gauze in my wounds, and still had IV bottles. That's back when the IV bottles were glass and they were big. So on my crutches, I had an IV bottle. But I had the note from General Westmoreland saying I could go back to my unit and I could walk. So I got to go back.
All right. So how much longer were you in country after that?
Till March the 7th.
Okay. So now we're coming home.
Yes, sir.
And the world has changed a little bit, didn't it?
Well, the response was not what I would have desired. Yes, sir, indeed. The people met us in we flew into Travis Air Force Base because I flew home military.
Mm-hmm.
Then they said, well, those that want to fly home military fall out in this line. Those that are going to fly home commercial, fly home over there. Well, to fly home military didn't cost you nothing, but from Travis Air Force Base, I think you had to go to Guam and
go west. Them, to go.
If you live on or left on Monday, you might get home on Friday or Saturday. Maybe. And if you flew commercial, the day you left is the day you got home. So all of us wanted to fly commercial, and they said, "Well, we can't allow you to go to the airport in military clothes,"
right,
which it just issued us brand new khakis. And we were all bummed on that fact, but they took us to the commissary, and because none of us had civilian clothes, and we all bought blue jeans and a V-neck pocket T-shirt, because that was about the only thing. Now they had suits and stuff like that, but 20-year-old guys don't necessarily want to go home in a suit. Wanted clean clothes on, so we all bought the same thing, and there we are standing in the parking lot and all dressed in blue jeans. I remember we had black high-top tennis shoes, blue jeans, and the white T-shirt. That's the way we were all dressed. But we had got our civilian clothes, so he said, get on the bus. So it took about, two and a half hours, something like that, in the bus to take us to the airport, San Francisco Airport. And on the way there, our sergeant explained to us why we couldn't wear military clothes and what the hippies there were willing to do. And he thought the reason why they were doing it was just to get on TV, because all they had to do is beat up a soldier and they got on TV. So
right.
He said, don't fall into that trap. Just don't pay any attention to them. They'll do amazing things to try to get you to negatively respond.
Right. They really tried to provoke us as we were going into San Francisco. I remember that one.
They did. So there were three of us flying into Indianapolis, Indiana. So we went to the ticket counter and Eastern Airlines and got our ticket and walked out the lobby and down the corridor that led to where our aircraft was departing from. Well, when we came around the corner of the lobby to go down that corridor, well, there was a group of 20 or so hippies that were there dressed in the traditional hippie attire, the long loose gowns and the rope waist and the long greasy hair, and that was the guys.
Right.
And the lead hippie come traipsing up to him and he said, hey, dude, if you want to get to your aircraft, you have to run our gauntlet. And we looked at each other and we said, well, okay. So we're not going to run it. We'll march through it. So we picked up our duffel bags and I actually called Cadence. going down their gauntlet, and they had, most of them had, they were not clubs, they were objects of art. They were big clubs is what they were, canes, but they were handmade, they were big clubs. And after about the third or fourth guy, when we didn't respond, they were rubbing, well, they had it in paper bags, what they picked up in their yard after their dog had been there, and worse, and they were rubbing it in their hair, and then rubbing it on our T-shirts, and then the farther we got down the line when we didn't respond, they started trying to rub it in their mouth and get it in their ears, and, but we kept rolling, and I heard the kid from Wabash, Indiana behind me go, oh, and I look over my shoulder, now we all had white T-shirts on, and I could see that his T-shirt was just splattered with blood. Well, they had hit him right across the head, forehead with one of those objects of art. But we kept rolling, and when we got past the last of the hippies, well, we stopped and set our duffel bags down, and we turned and we looked at each other. That was the first time that we really looked at each other, and all of us had, because they'd hit us all in the head, and we were all bleeding. I mean, none of it real bad, but still. And we, when we seen each other, we knew that the three of us was getting ready to take out 20 hippies. That was, you know.
I admire your restraint. I don't know how you were able to do that.
But when we looked at the hippies, there where we had started was the Live at 5 TV camera.
Oh, absolutely.
And the red light was blinking. So they had just videoed everything that had just happened. And I have tried 48 years to get that video, and they couldn't find it. They didn't have it available.
So
I called attention, and we saluted the camera and those 20 hippies, and we picked up our duffel bags and went to the little counter where our aircraft was going to depart from. And, of course, the stewardesses knew already what had just happened. I don't know if they'd seen it, but they'd heard that what had happened. And they took us – this is when you had to go outside to get on the airplane.
Right.
And they took us outside, and it was at least an hour and a half before our plane was to leave. But they took us out, and they put us in first class, and they took our bloody shirts off of us and gave us long-sleeve white shirts, which was probably the pilot's shirts, and – cleaned us all up, put Band-Aid on our head, and gave us each a glass of champagne. And none of us had really had champagne. We'd had Boone's Farm, but we'd never had champagne.
A little bit of Black Label beer. That was about the extent of it.
And we toasted each other. And then when we landed in Indianapolis, of course, all of us had called our mom and dads, letting them know when we were going to be in Indianapolis. And when we landed in Indianapolis, well, they had a big sign that said, "Welcome home, son. We're proud of you. We love you." So that reception was awesome.
Wow. Oh, we only got 3 minutes left? My goodness.
Well, time passes quickly.
It does pass quickly.
Do you quit trying?
I'd never quit trying. Never.
My wife has written a book also about us, and it's got Tim Holliday in it, and the name of her book is Endless Love and Second Chances.
Well, I think we're going to have Dixie on the program with you again. I hope you will agree to come back.
We can do that, sir.
Well, I would really enjoy that. It was such a pleasure to talk to you today, Sammy, and I want to
thank you, brother.
Thank you for your service, and I encourage everybody to go out and get this book. I'm going to fill up a little bit because we're going to play a little tune for you as we go out on the program today called The Last Patrol.
Outstanding.
And, I know that you mentioned that in the book, and so I said, I've got that one. And we've got all of them. And I believe you were on our program before. I think you talked with Gary Lilly.
Yes, sir, I did.
At some point, and he was so impressed, and I am as impressed as well. And unfortunately, Gary is no longer with us. But I want to thank you again for being on our program. The book is You Don't Lose Till You Quit Trying, and this is a theme that we hear from all of our veteran guests on our program. Guys, never give up. Never surrender, and we will be there to help you whenever we can. And so we'll schedule another time so we can talk about your trip back to Vietnam. All righty?
All right, sir.
All right, thank you very much. Hang on the air because we're going to be playing your program here in just your music here in just a second. How much time have I got?
Brother, thank you.
Thank you, Sammy. All right, we're going to hit the last patrol. Until then, till next week, you're dismissed. Listen to this whole thing, Veterans Radio's production of Veterans Radio LLC. And this program will be up on our website shortly. And thank you very much. Until then, you are dismissed.
Live, live, live right there. Your live, live, live right there. I'm telling you if you don't know.
I'm telling you if you don't know.
Something's coming down the road.
Something's coming down the road.
We call ourselves the last patrol.
We call ourselves last patrol.
We come to bring our brothers home.
We come to bring our brothers home.
Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Bring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
B-O-W-M-I-A.
B-O-W-M-I-A.
Shame of all the USA.
Shame of all the USA.
How can you look the other way?
How can you look the other way?
That ain't the way that we were raised.
That ain't the way that we were raised.
Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Ring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We don't want no more your lies.
We don't want no more your lies.
We don't want no alibis.
We don't want no alibis.
We don't want no monkey bones.
We don't want no monkey bones.
We just want our brothers home.
We just want our brothers home.
Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Bring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Don't you tell me to forget.
Don't you tell me to forget.
It ain't even over yet.
It ain't even over yet.
Don't you tell me not to care.
Don't you tell me not to care.
That's my brother over there.
That's my brother over there.
That's my sister over there.
That's my sister over there.
Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Bring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We fought your dirty stinking war.
We fought your dirty stinking war.
Now you don't need us anymore.
Now you don't need us anymore.
Sold us out for a dollar.
Sold us out for a dollar.
Then you called it peace with honor.
Then you called it peace with honor.
Balderdash.
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 Bring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We're tired of all your silly games.
We're tired of all your silly games.
We're kicking butt and taking names.
We're kicking butt and taking names.
We're tired of VA running around.
We're tired of VA running around.
We want respect, we want it now.
We want respect, we want it now.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
For those that keep this country free.
For those that keep this country free.
J-U-S-T-I-C-E.
J-U-S-T-I-C-E.
For those who keep our liberty.
For those who keep our liberty.
L-I-B-E-R-T-Y.
L-I-B-E-R-T-Y.
Those who paid the highest price.
Those who paid the highest price.
Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Bring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Coming down the long highway.
Coming down the long highway.
Walking, talking history.
Walking, talking history.
Listen up to what I say.
Listen up to what I say.
We ain't gonna go away.
We ain't gonna go away.
We call ourselves last patrol.
We call ourselves last patrol.
Check us out, we're walking tall.
Check us out, we're walking tall.
America, hear the call.
America, hear the call.
We want our rights, we want them all.
We want our rights, we want them all.
America, hear the call.
America, hear the call.
We want them home, we want them all.
We want them home, we want them all.
America, hear the call.
America, hear the call.
United we stand, divided we fall.
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 Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Bring them all home.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Thank you.